the state of South Dakota, the Honorable David Gilbertson presiding, is now open for the transaction of any business that may legally come before it.
Good morning. The first case for oral argument this morning is Tabitha Poirier, appellant versus the Smith Insurance Company, appellee. For the appellant, we have Mr. Robert Morris, an attorney from Belfouche. And for the appellee, we have Ms. Jessica Larson, an attorney from Rapid City. Mr. Morris, you may proceed, sir, and you have 20 minutes.
Good morning. May it please the court, Chief Justice, Ms. Larson. Tabitha Poirier, back in October 2006, was involved in a serious automobile accident. She was struck by a young gentleman by the name of Jamie Yellow Horse, who ultimately pled guilty to a vehicular battery and DUI. As a result of that accident, Ms. Poirier had in excess of $250,000 of medical expenses and serious injuries. Now, the vehicle that Mr. Yellow Horse was driving had a minimum financial responsibility liability limit insurance with Dairyland of $25,000. Tabitha was driving a 2000 Neon, Dodge Neon, that was insured by her mother with Geico for $100,000 of $100,000 of underinsured coverage. The Dairyland policy paid the $25,000 limits because there was no question as to Mr. Yellow Horse's liability. Then, pursuant to the mechanism under our underinsured laws, the $25,000 liability limits was set off against the $100,000 worth of underinsured limits that was provided by Geico on the Dodge Neon. So Tabitha got $100,000 total, but she has in excess of $250,000 of damages, which the parties have stipulated to for purposes of this declaratory judgment. So as we stand here today, Tabitha has remaining uncompensated damages in excess of $150,000.
And you made no additional claim against Geico?
No, none.
Okay.
Because under the scenario, it's the liability limits set off against the underinsured. The difference of the limits, I believe, is what this court has referenced in the past. So we have $150,000 worth of uncompensated damages. Tabitha, which isn't uncommon anymore, is a child of divorced parents. She lived with her father, resided in her father's household, was a family member. And her father, Doug, had a policy of insurance with DeSmit Insurance that insured all of the vehicles in that household, but it did not insure, as a named vehicle, the Dodge Neon. So you have the underinsured coverage that is available through Geico that was provided by Tabitha's mother's policy. Then you have the insurance with DeSmit that Tabitha is insured as a result of her being a family member. So we made a claim to DeSmit, and we said, we have $150,000 of uncompensated damages. You have underinsured coverage. DeSmit said, we are not going to pay for two reasons. One is that we have an exclusion in our policy that says we do not provide coverage for a vehicle that is owned but not insured under the DeSmit policy. Secondly, they said even if we did provide coverage, the South Dakota Supreme Court in the Nickerson case says once you receive the $100,000 in this case, even though there may be another $100,000 available of underinsured coverage, you are not allowed to stack that coverage, and all you get is $100,000. So I recognize the first hurdle we have to get over is the owned but not insured exclusion valid? And my position is, on behalf of Tabitha, that under the facts of this case, it is an invalid exclusion under our public policy. Now, yesterday I was here and I listened to the Sioux Falls case, and there was discussion about the ordinances and unconstitutional on its face, or unconstitutional in its application. And I'm not a constitutional scholar by any means. But I got to thinking, that's kind of what we have here. The exclusion of owned but not insured in this case is probably valid in a specific fact situation. Say, for instance, there is five vehicles. I believe there are four or five vehicles in the Poirier household. Let's say that Mr. Poirier insures one vehicle and then does not insure the rest of the vehicles whatsoever. That, in that specific case, that exclusion is probably valid because the risk hasn't been underwritten, the insured is attempting to get a free ride, and is not insuring all of the vehicles. And then probably to say there's coverage, even though all the vehicles aren't insured, is probably makes that exclusion valid in that fact situation. In this fact situation, all of the vehicles that Mr. Poirier had were insured with the Smith. Tabitha's vehicle that was titled in Doug or Tabitha Poirier was also insured. And so when we're here asking the court, and we're asking the court to do, when we're seeking these uncompensated damages, we're not asking you to make the Smith the primary carrier, because the primary carrier is all has been and always will be GEICO. What we're asking is that once we get by the owned but not insured exclusion in the DeSmet policy, we are asking to access the second tier of coverage, the excess coverage under the DeSmet insurance for underinsured coverage to compensate Tabitha. Now, the owned but not insured in our case, I believe, is invalid because what it does is it prevents full compensation under South Dakota law. The court has said, and the legislature established and the court has acknowledged, underinsured coverage in South Dakota is mandatory. And when you look at the public policy regarding the underinsured coverage and uninsured coverage, they're two separate things. But you look at the policy, and any time there's an attempt by the insurance company to minimize the ability of the insured to gain full compensation or the full rights and benefits under that policy, anytime that is attempted to be minimized that violates public policy in light of the mandatory coverage, that's void. And so in this case, it's our position that the owned but not insured exclusion as to apply to the facts of this case is void.
Let me ask, though, how does South Dakota public policy make it invalid for make an insurance company have to provide or underwrite coverage for a vehicle that it doesn't know about and it never formulated a premium for? How does the policy say that they have to insure that vehicle without having had a chance to calculate the premium for it?
And for this reason, the insurance company isn't insuring the vehicle. The insurance company is insuring the person. The person in this case is Tabitha Poirier. Under the DeSmet policy, her father, Doug, was the named insured. Tabitha, as a result of being a family member, a blood relative that resides in that household, she qualifies as an insured under that policy.
So you're saying then that the policy premium is not based upon what vehicles and how many vehicles are being covered, underwritten?
It is as to the DeSmet policy and the four or five vehicles that were listed. They provided underinsured and
this
uninsured.
Is a vehicle that's not listed, right? This is a vehicle that was unlisted. Well, right. Let's take, these cases typically come up when it's a motorcycle, very dangerous vehicle. And so if we had a situation here where this was a motorcycle that the father didn't list as insured, and now she's injured on that motorcycle, obviously, if the company had known there was a motorcycle that she was going to be riding on, and that wouldn't they have calculated a premium that would have covered that situation?
Absolutely. If it would have been a part of the household and it would have been under the DeSmit policy,
right.
Yes, as a listed vehicle, because it would be the primary coverage. We're not asking for DeSmit to be the primary coverage. Now, I wouldn't be here on behalf of Tabitha probably if the Dodge Neon was uninsured, did not have any coverage under it, and attempt to make the claim under the DeSmit policy.
I understand that, but you are asking an insurance company that doesn't cover the Neon to pay underinsured coverage for that Neon, even though they didn't know it existed and there was no premium calculated to include it.
I understand.
Isn't that right? I mean, that's what you're asking here.
What I'm asking is that Tabitha, as the person, who is the individual who is cloaked with the underinsured coverage under the DeSmit policy, that she be compensated for the underinsured coverage that she's entitled to. And I think, you know, when you look at the underinsured and uninsured area, is that the public policy is established by the legislature is that it is for the insured and the person in order to carry out the policy, and that is to compensate them in catastrophic and in serious accident cases when there is no liability insurance.
Well, that's what Colorado has said. Colorado says it follows the person. It's portable.
Right.
And it is portable even in South Dakota. Because
correct.
If she were injured in a non-owned, non-insured vehicle, if she were, for example, with a friend and a motorcycle,
correct.
She would be insured under, assuming that Nickerson doesn't kick her out because of that. Because
sure.
Of that.
Right.
So that's true, but in all the states that have looked at this, aside from a few, they say, well, wait a minute, how can we penalize the insurance company when they didn't know that this vehicle existed and their premium, they didn't charge a premium for it? I mean, that's the problem, that's the hurdle I guess I'm having here, and my problem is how do we say it's against public policy for an insurance company to make a deal with the father, say, okay, we'll insure the vehicles that you've asked us to insure, and we'll make it. How do we make them pay for something that they didn't insure, they didn't anticipate?
I would be with you 100% if we were asking for DeSmit to be the primary insurance, but we're not. GEICO is the primary insurance. And that was.
But isn't the effect the same here? When you have a child who's injured so severely that she's got more injuries than can be covered by primary insurance, the effect is the same. DeSmit now is being asked to pick up as if it were a primary because as you say, these facts generate the requirement that they pay.
Correct. But my point being is we're not asking them to be the primary. When they go through the process of underwriting, they're underwriting the risk. They're underwriting the type of vehicle and those sorts of things. And they're doing that, and there has to be a recognition of the fact that when Tabitha would be in a friend's vehicle, okay, if she's in a friend's vehicle and it's an uninsured or an underinsured situation, the hierarchy, the process is the insurance on the vehicle is primary. And then your personal insurance becomes secondary. Okay, that's the same. That's how the process I believe is being presented here. We're not asking DeSmit to be primary. We're asking DeSmit to be the secondary, and we're only asking them to be secondary if she has uncompensated damages under the law and under the policy. Because when they wrote the risk, they did the primary risk.
Help me with this. Assuming that we agree with you, how do we formulate a rule that doesn't encompass all the other circumstances where somebody says, well, I've got three cars I want to insure, but I'm not going to mention the motorcycle because that'll shoot my premium high up. But then when there's an accident on the motorcycle, they're covered. How do we write a rule that only applies to Tabitha or people like Tabitha, but doesn't include all these other scenarios where the company ends up having to c- cover something that they're not insuring.
I think you write the rule like this. If you are an insured and you are involved in an accident in an owned but not insured vehicle, and you're making claim under the policy that has an owned but not insured exclusion, you can only make a claim to the secondary coverage, not primary. Because under the primary philosophy, let's say that one of the vehicles that was insured under the policy, the Schmidt policy, wasn't insured, and Tabitha was in that vehicle, then I wouldn't be here. But we're not making a claim, and that's where the distinction comes in, I think, is are you making the claim under the primary policy, under the hierarchy that's been established, that the insurance on the vehicle? If there is no insurance on the vehicle, then you're done. But we have insurance on the vehicle, in this case GEICO, which is the primary after the liability. Now we're making claim under the underinsured because of her status as a family member. And that Schmidt agrees that it's portable. And so that insurance covers her, whether she's out as a pedestrian, whether she's on a bicycle, whether she's in someone else's vehicle, those sorts of things, because the common denominator becomes, are you a person and are you an insured that was injured by a motor vehicle? And it's the fact that a motor vehicle was involved in the case that contributed to it, that's what invokes various uninsured, underinsured laws that we have in South Dakota. So I think you can fashion it as you can say, if you're making a claim for primary coverage and it's an owned but not insured, you can't make that claim. But because we have insurance that is portable, and if you fall under the definition of an insured, if you make a secondary claim, and again, I'm getting ahead of myself because I'm assuming you're going to allow me to make a secondary claim because of the existence of Nickerson. If you make a secondary claim and you're an insured, that owned but not insured exclusion will not apply.
But basically, in order to get to the Nickerson hurdle, we have to say that the policy exclusion is against public policy in this case.
Again, and I think it's a little too bold for me to say it's against public policy in total, because I understand that there is that situation where the public policy, you don't want the insurance company to be paying out money for insurance that it never got paid for in the premium. But we don't have that case here. All the vehicles that were involved in this case, all the vehicles under the DeSmit policy, the Yellow Horse vehicle, and Tabitha's vehicle with GEICO, all these vehicles were insured. What it boils down to...
But the cases you rely on do, in fact, simply say that provision, like the Colorado case, they simply say that provision is against public policy in Colorado. Those are the cases you rely on. The rule you're asking us to adopt today, as I understand it from reading your brief, that rule doesn't exist anywhere. You're asking us to make a unique rule for South Dakota, are you not?
I guess I'm a little confused.
Okay, I can ask again.
The Colorado case, I agree, is the only case I could find that addressed the issue.
Right.
But just because there's not a bunch of cases out there, that doesn't mean I'm wrong.
No, I'm not. I can see that. I can see that. I'm just saying that. But the rule you want us to adopt today would be a unique rule in the United States.
It would be for this. To this extent, is I'm not asking you to say that the owned but not insured is totally void. What I am asking you to say is, again, we want to kind of go back to the constitutional, the ordinance being unconstitutional on its face or in its application. In this case, I'm asking you to rule that the owned but not insured is void in its application. And I think that's a very definitive path that the court can take. I'm running out of time. The Nickerson case, I think we addressed it in the briefs. What I tried to point out is that in Fenn, you have uninsured, you allowed stacking. Nickerson, 11 years ago, it was no stacking and underinsured. There's no difference. Intra-policy, which is the stacking, and I look at it from an office. Intra-policy, you can't stack. There's no prohibition of inter-policy stacking.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Morris. Ms. Larson, you have 20 minutes.
May it please the court, counsel. Tabitha Poirier is precluded from recovering under the DeSmet insurance policy for two reasons. First, as Mr. Morris discussed, because she was driving an owned but not insured vehicle, which was excluded from the policy. And second, because South Dakota law prohibits stacking underinsured motorist coverage from two policies in an attempt to recover beyond the policy limits. The reason the owned but not insured exclusion applies in this case is because the Plymouth Neon that Ms. Poirier was driving was titled under the name Doug or Tabitha Poirier, but it was not insured under the DeSmet insurance policy. And Tabitha Poirier was both a covered driver listed under the policy, and she was also a family member because she resided with the insured. The Poiriers instead, for whatever reason, chose to insure the Plymouth Neon under Tabitha's mother's GEICO insurance policy. And I agree with Mr. Morris that on its face, the owned but not insured exclusion is valid. It does not violate any public policy, and it does not violate any statute.
Of course, we've never said that. That's an issue of first impression in South Dakota, whether it is or not.
Right. And while it's a matter of first impression, there's a generous amount of South Dakota authority that can provide guidance on the issue to show that it's a valid exclusion. For example, the legislature has recognized the right of insurance companies to place conditions on underinsured motorist coverage. If you look at the language of SDCL 5811.9.5, that statute begins with the language subject to the terms and conditions of such underinsured motorist coverage. It then goes on to say that an insurer must provide an insured with uncompensated damages up to the policy limits. But the legislature put right in there at the very beginning that an insurance company could list terms and conditions to underinsured motorist coverage. And of course, we all know that the terms and conditions have to be in accordance with public policy. But in Glow versus Iowa Mutual Insurance Company in 2005, this court stated that just because policy language narrows coverage, that doesn't automatically make it inconsistent with public policy.
Well, in this case, isn't it the owned but not insured provision? I think we understand the purpose of that is to not allow someone to not insure a vehicle and still gain coverage for that vehicle. Isn't this a little bit different situation where they're only seeking the secondary coverage? And DeSmet was paid for secondary coverage, and they would never underwrite for whatever vehicle might be out on uninsured or underinsured and hit a vehicle. They wouldn't ever know about that vehicle until the collision occurred in secondary coverage. So haven't they, in fact, been paid for that coverage?
Well, in this particular circumstance, that would not be the case. There were four particular vehicles insured under this policy, and generally, an insurance company weighs their risks by scenarios, and a person is much more likely to be occupying a vehicle that they own rather than occupying a vehicle that someone else owns. So an insurance company may be more willing to underwrite a slightly less likely risk, that being a person being injured in an accident when they're in a vehicle that they do not own, without charging an increased premium.
Is there any evidence in this case at all that their underwriting was based on that?
You know, In this case, there are four vehicles listed on the Desmet insurance endorsement. Tabitha Pereira was listed as a covered driver. Desmet based its premiums on the listed vehicles, just as any insurance company does in any given case. The more risk a certain type of vehicle, the higher the premium.
Is that in any of the record, how they determine what risk and the cost of it and what they're actually charging? I mean, they obviously are covering her no matter what otherwise vehicle she would be injured in. Was there any testimony in this record? When you read some of these other cases, it appears that there was a lot of testimony presented to the court on how the insurance company determines risk and what they're covering and how they would charge. Is there anything in this record along that line?
Sure. In this record, we've stipulated to the facts that there were four vehicles covered. Four vehicles were paid a premium. However, there was no stipulation as to how DeSmet determined the premium to be charged to Mr. Pereira on his insurance policy covering those four vehicles.
Does the policy show that the premiums are based on the cars insured or the people insured? Can you tell that much?
In this particular case, I cannot tell how the breakdown was made up. However, you can decipher that each of the four vehicles had the underinsured motorist coverage, the liability coverage, and other coverages, and the Plymouth Neon that Tabitha Pereira was driving was not insured under the policy. There are several reasons why this court should not make an exception in this particular circumstances. There's essentially no case law holding that under a certain set of facts like this one, where you've got a primary insurer and an excess insurer, that the insurance company should be essentially have to insure against liability that it did not, against a risk that it did not foresee when writing the policy.
That's what underinsured and uninsured is that's a risk that they do insure against.
I agree with you. However, as I had stated, the exclusion is reasonable here because it excludes a material unassumed risk. The risk is material in this case because this was Tabitha Pereira's car. She drove it consistently on a consistent basis and therefore was much more likely to be injured in an accident when driving her own vehicle. That makes that risk a much more material risk than, say, if she had been in a friend's vehicle driving.
But there's nothing in the record about that. You're saying that, but there's no evidence in the record to say that that's what the underwriting was based on.
You're right. I'm actually referring to case law. For example, Clampett versus State Farm Mutual Auto Insurance, which came out of Arkansas in 1992. And in that case, the court did go in depth into some public policy reasons behind an insurance company's reasons for having owned but not insured exclusions. And you know, they determined that it was a reasonable exclusion because a company could be expected to charge a higher premium in cases, and it would be unfair to ask other insurers to share the cost of the increased exposure of covering vehicles that are owned but not insured. And so
we don't really know if that's the case. I mean, we don't. There's nothing in this record that would indicate in 2011 that the Smith had that in mind when they determined the premium. There's nothing in this record.
There is nothing in the record that says that DeSmet considered whether or not Tabitha Pereira would be driving her own vehicle when it determined the premium. You're
right,
correct.
You're talking about vehicle. What if she was walking down the street, no vehicle involved at all?
You're right. Then the exclusion would not apply.
So it applies to the person, not to the vehicle.
Generally, uninsured and underinsured motorist coverage does apply to the person, and it is portable, except in cases, and there are very limited exclusions in the policy that exclude for risks that the insurance company has determined are beyond what it is willing to cover without charging an additional premium. This court has upheld exclusions in underinsured motorist coverage specifically in Cimarron Insurance Company versus Croyle, the court upheld an underinsured motorist policy that excluded coverage for any vehicle owned by the insured. It excluded all of the insured's vehicles, whether or not they were insured under the policy or not. And the court looked to SCCL 5811.9.5, and it stated that the clear implication of the language in that statute is that underinsured motorist coverage may be subject to certain terms and conditions. And if in that case an insurer was able to exclude all of the insured's vehicles, whether or not a premium was paid, certainly an exclusion where no premium has been paid would be valid and consistent with public policy. I would also like to point out that in this case, the insured had the choice of where to insure the vehicle. That's a common theme throughout all of the case law, whether it be in the Eighth Circuit. In
of course, in this case, Tabitha didn't have a choice. I mean, she's a minor, and so her parents, divorced parents, both made their decision about what was going to be insured and how. You know, so maybe you could address Mr. Morris's rule that he's asking us to, his limited rule he's asking us to take. You know, what about the fact now we're talking about a child and we're talking about coverage, secondary coverage here? Should we be looking at an exception in this kind of unique circumstance?
I understand the point. However, I disagree that there should be an exception because that is how insurance coverage is handled for minors. Their parents purchase the policy of insurance. That happens all the time, whether it be a single family unit or whether it's a divorced family and they have to make a choice on to which parent's insurance the child's vehicle or coverage will be. In this case, Tabitha Puryear was covered by insurance. She received the full benefits of an underinsured motorist policy. The purpose of uninsured motorist coverage is to make the injured party the same as if the motorist, that the tortfeasor that struck them, had been insured to the limit, excuse me, to the minimum amount of liability insurance. That happened in this case. Tabitha Puryear received the $25,000 minimum liability policy, and she also received $75,000 from GEICO, and so she was compensated to an amount that South Dakota statutes determine to be the amount necessary listed in the statutes. And here I realize we've stipulated that Ms. Puryear had excess damage. However, in this case, she received the benefit of her bargain. I know that seems a little bit harsh to say to an injured person, but she and her parents bargained for $100,000 in underinsured motorist coverage, and she received $100,000 as a result of her injuries in this accident. And essentially, the case cited by Mr. Morris in support of his opinion is the James case out of Colorado, like you had discussed. And in that case, the court said that it didn't address public policy considerations for why an insurance company may need owned but not insured exclusion in their underinsured motorist policy, but instead it held that the vehicle occupied could never be considered. You can't consider the vehicle at all when determining underinsured motorist coverage, but that is inconsistent with South Dakota law. As I had stated a couple of minutes ago in Cimarron, this court upheld an underinsured motorist coverage exclusion that excluded all the insured's vehicles. So we know that pursuant to SDCL 5811.9.5, the insurance company can add terms and conditions to the underinsured motorist coverage, and pursuant to the Cimarron decision, that those terms and conditions may be added to exclude certain vehicles for underinsured motorist coverage. And, you know, South Dakota is consistent with all of the jurisdictions that uphold owned but not insured exclusions in the context of underinsured motorist coverage. We have similar statutes. We have similar background of case law. And under the plain and ordinary meaning of the DeSmet insurance policy language, Tabitha Puryear was not covered for underinsured motorist benefits while driving the owned but not insured vehicle. However, even if the owned but not insured provision did not apply in this case, Ms. Pereira would not be able to recover under the dismissal insurance policy because the concept of stacking in connection with underinsured motorist coverage is well settled in South Dakota. Stacking of underinsured motorist coverage from two different policies in an effort to recover an amount greater than the policy limits is not allowed. The concept is set out in both statutes and in case law, and most notably, like I've spoken about several times today, SDCL 5811.9.5, which is known as the difference of limits statutes, provides that underinsurance coverage is limited to the limits on the vehicle of the party recovering less the amount paid by the liability insurer. In Nickerson, this court explained that an excess underinsured motorist coverage insurer, which would be dismissed in this case, is entitled to offset amounts paid both by the liability insurer and by the primary underinsured motorist carrier. In that case, Nickerson received $50,000 from the liability insurer and $50,000 from the primary underinsured motorist coverage carrier. And the court deducted that amount, the $100,000, from the $100,000 excess policy. It's exactly the same in this case. Here we have GEICO as the primary underinsured motorist carrier. The Dairyland liability policy was $25,000. GEICO, the primary carrier, $75,000. That total of $100,000 would be subtracted from the dismissed excess policy, which would leave no recovery.
Is there a difference with Nickerson, however, that in Nickerson the damages were, if I remember correctly, $100,000? And so they really would have received double recovery. That's not the case in this case because there are injuries that have not yet been paid.
I don't believe there is a distinction. In Nickerson, they did stipulate to the damages as we have here. However, the court set out in a clear holding that the excess insurer is entitled to offset amounts paid by both the liability and the primary underinsured carrier. That's been upheld several times. The Fenn versus Progressive Insurance Company has stated that this court has consistently held that an insured may not stack underinsured coverage to amounts greater than the amount contracted for. And so in this case, the amount contracted for was $100,000. You can't add those up to make $100,000, $200,000, $225,000. You're contracting for $100,000. In addition, as recently as 2006 in Hockett versus LaPointe, the court quoted Nickerson and acknowledged that SDCL 5811.9.5 prohibits the stacking of underinsured motorist coverage from two policies. It's a little bit different than uninsured motorist coverage. My colleague has stated that they're the same. However, they're not the same. The reason why uninsured motorist coverage is a little bit different is because the court's decision in Westfall in 1973 has been upheld continuously. However, since 1973, the legislature has enacted various statutes that have limited and prevented stacking of underinsured motorist coverage, where they've sort of left certain aspects of uninsured motorist coverage alone. And South Dakota law has been clear and consistent. Stacking from two policies in an effort to recover more than the policy limits is not allowed. In this case, coverage was precluded by the owned but not insured exclusion. And in addition, Ms. Pereira is prevented from stacking her underinsured policies. And therefore, if this court has no further questions, I would ask that you please affirm the summary judgment order and the court.
Thank you, Ms. Larson. Mr. Morris, you have 10 minutes, sir.
Thank you, Your Honor. It's very evident the young lawyers today are a lot smarter than they were 23 years ago. The The thing that's troubling, that troubles me about DeSmit's position is that they got paid all the premiums under their policy. And we probably wouldn't be here if Tabitha would have been driving one of those vehicles. We wouldn't be here if Tabitha would have been a pedestrian. We wouldn't be here if Tabitha was on a bicycle. Because in those situations, then we could have, in my view, applied and sought the damages for uncompensated damages without running into this owned but not insured problem. Also, it was fortuitous that she ends up getting hit by someone who has the minimum amount of insurance, $25,000. Because if he hadn't had any insurance, then we would have been going into the uninsured area. And we wouldn't have to be then dealing with, is there a set off? Is between the underlying and the secondary and the primary insurance. So this perfect storm that's happened in this case has created a quandary, and I agree, a quandary for me, and I'm sure it creates a quandary for you. But the thing is, it's Tabitha that we're here about. Tabitha has... any way you look at it, right now she's got $150,000 of uncompensated damages. If the court should agree with our legal position and say, DeSmit, pay that $100,000 of underinsured coverage that follows Tabitha wherever she goes, she still has $50,000 worth of uncompensated damages. But what I think this case allows this court to do is... make that fine distinction under the facts of the case. What's the case the court has done before? Make that fine distinction. We have a minor. We have insurance that was primary for underinsured coverage. Three, we have an owned but not insured exclusion that although it may be valid, it is not valid in this particular situation because the insurance is personal and Tabitha only seeks the secondary layer of coverage.
The problem, what I'm struggling with is you make a compelling argument. Look, where in South Dakota do we find this public policy that says that this clause is against it? That's what I'm struggling with. Where in South Dakota do we find that?
There's no case on point because this is a case of first impression. And if I look at the other cases where the court has addressed the public policy, let's go back to Westfall. Ms. Larson said Westfall. In Westfall, in 1973, I believe it was, in that case, the court said the other insurance provisions in an uninsured case were void as against public policy because they essentially were attempt to allow, they were anti-stacking provisions, okay? What the court, I believe, said in that case is when you have mandatory insurance, and that's your basic first premise, is the insurance mandatory? Underinsured coverage is mandatory in South Dakota. When that's your basic premise, is it mandatory? Any attempt by the insurance company to limit the ability for the insured to seek the maximum benefits available under the policy are void. Okay? Then I believe we got to, we have the Cimarron case, and my recollection is the Cimarron case had to do with the household exclusion. And in that case, the court said, we have our public policy established by the legislature is that we have minimum financial responsibility laws. And to exclude a family member from that coverage if they're injured by the negligence of another family member is void as a matter of public policy as it pertains to our mandatory minimum financial responsibility laws. Now, granted, the legislature turned around subsequently and specifically abrogated the holding, which was their expression of public policy. So in this case, we have mandatory insurance. We have a minor. We have a minor that's a family member in a household with her father. We have a vehicle that's in her father or her name. And I think that maybe that's probably a distinction, too. It says Doug or Tabitha. It doesn't say Doug. It says Doug or Tabitha. But I'm assuming that's more of one of those convenience things like a rights of survivorship issue. So we have the mandatory underinsured that was under the dismiss policy. We have her as a minor. She's living in her father's household. She has a vehicle that's in her dad's name and her name. And then her mother, who does not live in that same household, buys the insurance. And so the policy being is whether she's in that vehicle, one of the vehicles insured under the dismiss policy, as a pedestrian or on a bicycle, is there compensation for her in those events where the tortfeasor is not adequately insured to cover all of her damages? So when you go to the underinsured, it says uncompensated damages. And I think, Justice Severson, you pointed out in Nickerson. I've read Nickerson 100 times. And I cannot tell in that case whether she did have damages in excess of $100,000. My presumption was that she didn't because the court indicated that, well, the purpose of underinsured coverage is to give you full compensation. It is not to give you double recovery. So when I'm looking at Nickerson, when Nickerson says you can't stack, the way I interpret Nickerson is that if you have two policies of insurance that both provide 100 and your damages are only 100, you're only going to collect 100 because if you ask for 200, you're getting double recovery. We don't have a double recovery situation in this case. What we have is a recovery that regardless of how it comes out will be insufficient because even if DeSmit gives 100, there's still 50,000. You know, briefly, I'll get past the owned but not insured. And I know that's a hurdle. And I hope that I've tried to, and I've done as good a job as I can explaining. And granted, I'm asking you to be definitive, but as an advocate, that's what I have to do. We have the Nickerson case that came down in 2000, which was an underinsured case. And we come along and we come into, I believe, 2003, and we have the Fenn case. In the Fenn case, Ms. Fenn was on a motorcycle, had injuries, and it was an uninsured driver. The motorcycle had uninsured coverage. She had personal coverage of uninsured. And the attempt there was to prevent her from seeking both the primary and the secondary. Some people call it stacking. I like to call it primary and secondary because stacking has such a negative connotation. So I look at it as primary and secondary. And what this court says is there's no prohibition in our law for uninsured coverage for essentially inter-policy stacking. When you look at our anti-stacking statutes, I believe it's, as to uninsured, it's 5811.9.8. That is a prohibition of intra. And I keep it straight by saying intranet in my office, internet outside. Intra policy, where you can't take five vehicles and stack and get $500,000. But there's no prohibition in the statute that says you cannot stack inter-policies, which are multiple policies. And we would ask the court to remand with direction to enter judgment for Tabitha.
Thank you, Mr. Morris. The court will be in recess for 10 minutes.